Session number 3966, reel number 3.
John Milne, tape number 3. Why were you sent up country so soon after your arrival?
Well, they were short-staffed, as far as I know, but to me it was quite a surprise, and it was going to be quite an introduction to Nigeria in many ways. So, naturally, I was very pleased, it was a great experience. So, as I say, coming back to the loads and everything, having 100 loads of kit, approximately 100 loads of kit to take as well, and it made me very conscious of what I call coordination and cooperation, which was so necessary for any movements in Nigeria. There we had river transport, motor transport, railway transport. And then in this case, I was also just by foot. So there was the situation, and how important it was to look ahead, and you had to think ahead and coordinate all movements. So in this case, here was I, with a month in the country, going up country. And anybody's first time up country is a memory that will never be erased from one's mind. Was also fascinating and new. Everything was new. So I arrived in Aba, where I'd been just 3 weeks or so before, in the railway rest house. Next morning, everything loaded onto the train to go to Enugu. So it was only a 50-mile journey, and once again arrived in Enugu, which was a very important town in southern provinces. It was the headquarters too of the provincial office and of all the political, the district officer side and so on like that. Anyway, straight away all our loads were taken off and put into a railway carriage. Again, they had to be checked in, so everything was then checked into the railway carriage and sealed. Only my personal loads was then taken over to the railway rest house. This was a very nice rest house in Enugu, beautifully built and very airy and comfortable. So again, there was just the bare essentials and you had your camp equipment to use. So of course I settled in by this time I was having a cup of tea and just relaxing and wondering what was going to happen. The rest house was well clear of the railway station, so it was a compound all by itself. And then, all of a sudden, a car drove up, and somebody got out, and then a voice said, "My name is Farlin. I believe you're a Scot." And then, lo and behold, this chap arrived, and he was a miner from the coal mine, which Enugu was famous for. And made himself known, made me welcome, and said, "Right, oh, don't bother, I'll come and collect you tonight. You're up now at my place for dinner, and you'll meet some of our other friends in the coal mine." In fact, he said, "You'll come early," he said, "because we have a swimming pool, and you'll be able to have a swim, which you'll do instead of a bath." So there we are. That was my first introduction to the miners in the Enugu. And the introduction it was too. So I was collected early and went for a swim in the swimming pool, and then up to their quarters, which up in the Udi Hills, as it's called, and introduced to various other Europeans from different parts. There was a couple of Scots, there was an Irishman, man, two from Cumberland, two brothers, and so we had a wonderful evening.
Was this all male company?
They were all male company, yes.
Did you ever find, whilst you were out in Nigeria, in either of your tours, that there was any tensions or frustrations created by the lack of European women?
Not really. One got accustomed to it, but the situation now was that there was a system where European wine were being allowed out in more.
Are these civilian wives?
Yes, and BNCO's wives too. In fact, it was in the early 30s when BNCOs were allowed wine. Up to then, they hadn't. But officers, some of the senior officers, naturally, it was a good thing to have the senior people with their wives, because it was a very good thing socially and that too. So they were, that was coming in. Anyway, it was all male that night. In fact, it was 14 counting me. But of course, that was that. Anyway, so now next morning, the next stage of the journey was to go to Otakpo. So onto the train, we steamed out and up to a place called Otakpo, which was over 100 miles, I forget now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's quite well up the line. Again, this was very interesting too. The usual railway stops and the activity and the scrambling for food and so on, buying and bartering and so on. But again, it was a change of landscape that was always interesting. Beauty.
What were you changing? What was the landscape changing
from to? Thick bush country. It was beginning to, but we were still in what I call the bush country area. But there was the railway was an amazing feat of engineering in Nigeria. When you think on the hundreds of miles that was carved out in Nigeria, it was really amazing. And that, to me, was always an amazing thing. Anyway, there at Otakpo, offloaded all the loads. A native policeman met me with a letter from the district officer. He was sorry that he wasn't there to meet me, but would I come to his house for a meal that night? But he said, the messenger will see everything for you. So he explained what would happen. Again, this is where the coordination and cooperation comes in, because he had been informed, naturally, by the OC that I was travelling up with all the loads. He had to arrange all the carriers that was going to carry these loads for me, because I had 4 days' march to get to Angkor. So, therefore, the loads were all taken off, stacked and checked, and the policemen arranged that they would be safeguarded overnight. They didn't expect any trouble anyway, but anyway, that was all arranged, and next morning there would be the headman with all the carriers to transport these loads. I may mention, I think I forgot earlier on, that all these loads in Calabar had been weighed and checked and everything to keep within the 50 pounds weight, and they were all numbered. And of course, our load list showed exactly what each load had, and that. Anyway, that's just that's for information.
These loads lists seem to have made an indelible impression upon you.
Well, they were very most important. They were most important. You'll see why as we go on. So that, to me, that was documentation. Everything like that was impressed on you. Right. So now I settled in and had a bath. And then it was time to go to see the district officer. He said he would send his boy to take me along. He did. His house was away, clear of the railway, up sort of clear away from there. And his boy came and led me up to meet him. And as soon as I arrived, I saw this gentleman there. And as soon as he saw me, he said, "Oh, you were the Highland dancer." And much to my amazement, because he was first us, he had been on the Apapa, and so of course he saw my escapades as a Highland dancer, which made a lovely link straight away. We had something in common, and he naturally knew I was my first tour. But then he himself had served with the Nigerian Regiment in World War I, and so, of course, he was a lovely link. He knew exactly what the army was, and he couldn't do enough to make me at home. And that first evening there, he was given, he just talked and put me at home and gave very helpful suggestions of what was going to happen the next day, because the first time I'd been out, there was me with the carriers and loads, and he gave me tips of how to move up and down and only travel so many miles and rest them and things like that, which I wouldn't have had. I'd read on the in paper, but this was getting it word of mouth by a man who'd been out in Nigeria for quite a number of years.
What, in both your both tours, what impression did you get of the attitude of the other Europeans towards the army?
Very good. As far as I was concerned, they were all out to help. It was, as I say, cooperation and coordination. So in this case, there was this district officer, and he was most helpful. Little did I know that he would be at my wedding and living. But this is what happens in Nigeria. That's an aside. So therefore, that was Captain Money. He had his rank from his war days, and a very fine man too. So he made me at home and gave me a lot of helpful advice for my next 4 days, which was going through the bush. So next morning, started early, up at 6 o'clock, and all the loads were then laid out, and there was the head men, which he had arranged with the carriers, and all these African carriers were then allocated to the loads. This is what takes time. You can't travel, but it's interesting, and this is what you have to be prepared for. There is always tomorrow. Saigon, as they say. And so there we are. So if you can now picture these Africans being allocated their loads in position, and we are then, they're given the order to lift their loads, and off we go. So you've got this retinue of carriers walking in single file with the headman, and he also had two other men to help him, spaced out. And you, as the European, had the choice whether to go in front or go in rear, or go where you like. But anyway, I went in front for a start off to get the feeling of the walk, and then after every little halt, I then spaced myself in the centre or in the back, to in the rear.
It was far from being a silent journey.
It wasn't, no, because they love, again, we're coming to the Africans, they're so cheery, and they sing their songs. There's always somebody who is a leader, and this also goes with the army. And they sing their songs, and they have little flutes, sort of whistles made from sheep's horns and things like that, and they have these piercing notes, and that adds to it. And of course, if they can, they can always do a little bit of drumming, and some and the car and the wooden boxes that they had, they could rattle their fingers on the boxes as they're going along, keeping time like a drum. Anyway, that is a sort of the atmosphere you can get. There's not much to see, because this was a road that had been carved out to a place called Ida, but it had left to be overgrown, and there was just sufficient room to walk through. That was understandable. It was a motor road, or it could have been a motor road. It was eventually, of course. But anyway, as far as we were concerned, it was the road to march. Well, you only do about 12 miles a day. It doesn't seem much, but of course you had to take in consideration that these Africans were carrying 50 pounds in their heads, and they were civilians, so they couldn't be drilled as a soldier would. And that was that. So there was recognised rest houses where you stayed, where you stopped.
Who looked after the rest houses?
That was interesting again. The rest house was just an ordinary mud house with the thatching, grass roof or palms, the case may be. And there was always wood and water. That was the prime thing. There always had to be clean water and wood, so that you were able to have a bath and cook. The man in charge of the rest house, you usually found, in a lot of cases, were ex-servicemen, people that had been in the army, especially in this case, they'd been in World War One, because it was only 10 years previous sort of thing. And they were sort of in charge of the rest house, and so it was kept clean, and they had other little jobs too, helping out in the village, helping the headman of the village, and so on like that. Really, they were a sort of, in some cases, unofficial policemen, because A, the military discipline and their high standards, usually, of hygiene themselves, they were able to impart to the village.
going to ask you, what effect do you think that these men had on their villages when they returned?
Oh, very good. And, yes, it was again, it came back to the individual himself, but they were. They had learnt and imbibed, they'd been accustomed to discipline and a high standard of cleanliness and so on, so of course they were a valuable asset. So many of them, later on, you found, were in the what they call the native police, which I can deal with later on. And so they played an important part, not only after the war, their army service, in their civilian life too. So in this case, it so happened that they were ex-military.
Did these ex-military men keep their contacts with the army?
Oh yes, yes, yes. I'm jumping now to outstations. In particular, or headquarters, there was a list kept of all reservists. So when a man was finished his time and went on the reserve, he had to report to whatever station, outstation was nearest him. So you had a list of all reservists, and they came in once a quarter, and they received the reserve pay. We had a list of all people who had medal ribbons that were in the area, because they were very proud to wear their medals and their medal ribbons, so they used to come in and they were checked off and with a character certificate, and they were issued with new medal ribbons, especially if they were in the native police, you see. So of course they were very proud, and so we had a continual link all the time, which was a great thing. Now to come back, I must get a move on.
Well, anyway, how long did it take you to get to Angkor?
Yes. Well, I must mention the next day, because I thought this was very interesting to me. It so happened that the second day was a Saturday, and I arrived at this village and settled in. And again, of course, I was the only European so far, and I'd settled in and was having my tea when I sort of clap clap came, which was my first indication of this is how Africans approach the house. They can't knock at the door, because usually there's no doors in the rest house anyway, and this was an indication of somebody was waiting to wanted to see me. My boy immediately went to see who it was, and he came in and said, there's an African wanted to see you. So I said, I will bring him in. Now this was really my first contact with an African outside military circles, and so this African was brought in, and he introduced himself, and he was the local school teacher of the mission school in the village. So he made himself known. He was a Methodist. I knew about Methodists, but I'd never been anywhere near Methodists, because in the north of Scotland we were Church of England or Presbyterians, and that was that in my hometown. Anyway, he explained that he was a Methodist, and he was running the school, and would I like to come down that afternoon, or the evening, the cool, and see what they were doing, and would I like to come to the church service next morning? So I thanked him, and I said, yes, I'll go off to other people, have a cup of tea, which he did, and I said, yes, I would. Now this was, and I said, right, oh, I'll come along and see you later on, and that was that. So this, to me, was amazing. I knew a little bit about missions. I'd met Calabar, and that was at headquarters, but here was right out in the bush, and my first contact with an African in civilian life, as one would say. So I went down to the village, was met by this gentleman, and it was only a mud house, thatched roof, about 12 by 10 or something like that, only one chair and one table, but there was little mats scattered around. And this was their school, their church, their everything. It was just it had been built by the people themselves, which of course is quite easy in Africa. They can do anything with mud and thatch and grass and so on. And this, and he explained, this was their school, their everything. During the week and on Sunday it was the church service. So he invited me to the service next morning, and he asked if I would read the lesson. Now, little did he know that I'd never in my life read a lesson before. And I said, oh yes, well, what will it be? And he then quoted to me, he said, I would like you to read from St. John chapter 10, verses 11 to 16, which is, I am the good shepherd. So I said, right, thank you very much. He said, have you got a Bible? Well, fortunately I have, because we were issued with one in the army, but not that it's used much. But I said, yes, I have, which I did have. I said, righto, I'll do that. And there was that. So I went, returned home, and so that night I read up. As I say, I'd never read a lesson before in my life. Now you can picture, next morning, I was at the church service. There was all the Africans sitting there on the floor, and he did it all in their language, which was, I think it was Efik. I'm not really sure. I didn't know the language anyway, but he did all that. And then at one point, he asked me to read, and I read the lesson. He translated what it was, and he didn't know my how I was feeling, but I read this lesson in English, and that was that. Then he translated it into Efik or whatever it was, and so, and then there came the Lord's Prayer, which I of course said in English, and it was a most strange effect, but a wonderful effect. There was these people in the language that they were talking, and I was only conscious of my voice. And I can tell you, I never said the Lord's Prayer. So I never felt it so much in my life as I did that day. It was an amazing feeling, really. Anyway, to cut a long story short, this was my first contact with Methodist missionaries. And there was an African inviting me to a church service. I may say that it was the first of many over my years of Nigeria. Now, I've rather digressed, but I think it was most interesting to me there was an African who was really a missionary bringing me into the...
What impression did this make on you?
I was so impressed with what the Methodist, in this case the Methodist mission, were doing. There was this just an ordinary plain building that was being used for everything. A church, a school, a dispensary, everything that was possible. And it was only a small village, and there was this teacher who was everything. And he was a sort of... There was a village chief I met too, of course, and so on like that. But there was an outpost of the first Methodist mission that I saw. And that was one of many. But that was showing what was going on in the early days. This was in 1930. There was this Methodist teacher, a catechist, I think he was called. But anyway, that didn't matter. He was a jack of everything, really doing a wonderful job. Now, I must get on. So then, next day, of course, was Monday, so then I was off to Angkor, and I arrived at this outstation. Now, this was a headquarters station where there was a company of the 3rd Battalion. There was a captain, a lieutenant, there was a CQMS who was due to go and leave any minute, and myself. There was the four Europeans. You say, oh, that's a lot of people for a company, but the thing was, one had to cater for leaves and sickness, and you never knew how many Europeans you would have. But in this case, we had four. The district officer, the senior district officer, was at the headquarters. There was other DOs, but they were out on tour. In fact, I never saw another DO there, but there were other DOs who were responsible for other parts of the country. But this was a very fine man called Captain Mercer, DFC and MC from World War One, who went out to Nigeria just after World War One. There was a doctor. He was a Scot, of course, came from Edinburgh, Dr. Cormick, and he had a small hospital and dispensary and everything, and he, again, was out on tour and so on like that. So that was our strength.
Where was the where were the barracks situated?
Now, the barracks, the Europeans were in their own little area, except the BNCOs. Like in my case, we had ours was nearest the barracks because we were in between, and did more the routine work and that, and we had to be on hand.
Did you have individual accommodation?
Yes, we had little round grass houses, mud houses with grass roofs, and all the barracks were mud houses. They were mud houses, circular, with thatching, because it was a unit where you were self-contained and you were responsible for your own maintenance. And again, this the African troops, they could do it. They built houses before they joined the army, so they were able to do their own maintenance and that was done usually in the dry season, ready for the rainy season. That was all part and parcel of the programme of training and maintenance and everything in all units and outstations. So you were self-contained. So there we are, we had this barracks, and I was now settling into what I thought was going to be my first tour. I took over the stores from the sea commander. That's because he was waiting to go and leave. But he said, I won't be going and leave until you return from patrol. So I said, oh, what's this? Oh, he said, the company's going out next week. He said, for 3 weeks. So you've got to get organised for that. And, of course, it was all explained to me what we were doing.
What were you doing, in fact?
This was just... it was a form of indirect recruiting, also an opportunity to go around the various villages and show them the Africans. You know, we had to stay, and this was my job, as it turned out, to stage demonstrations of what the Africans can do with unarmed combat, as it was called in those days, or self-defense. And we also arranged firing of Lewis guns and rifles. And it was an indirect form of recruiting, but also, as there had been trouble, not so much in that area, it was sort of just showing, what could happen if there was any trouble, but it wasn't put over that way. Now, there was a lot of preparation that had gone into this before, because I was just came in at this time to go out with them. The company commander and the... with a district officer had arranged exactly where we were going and where the headquarters were going to be. They had wrecked the area and so on like that. So our first day was to get out. We went about 20 miles roughly. That was to get out to this area that had been partly cleared, and this was when my first introduction of how mobile and adaptable the African soldier is. With a minimum of time, they can are on the move, completely self-contained, no worries about movement, because we had to walk, or march, I should say, and there we are. And so, therefore, I had to get organised myself, and this was my first introduction of the minimum of personal loads that one can carry in supposed action. So,
what did you in fact carry?
Well, very little, just my uniform equipment, which of course in my case was only a revolver and a belt. We didn't need to carry a pack and anything like that, because that was contained with our carriers. And the thing was a chop box, as they call it. This was a box, is where your cooking utensils were. But in this case, it was everything was decided. There would be one kitchen. Well, the three of us, officers and myself, were all been cooked in the one thing, which was sensible, you see. This is what used to happen. So I didn't have to worry much about foodstuffs, because I...